Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Historian Jason Sokol's new book is All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. It's the story of how the region struggled to live up to its progressive reputation and has largely gone untold. He explains how the Northeast had publicly presented itself for centuries as a model of racial equality. After all, it was the birthplace of abolitionism and became a refuge for blacks fleeing the Jim Crow South. Yet those achievements belied a very different reality for most African Americans, who were shunted into ghettos and filtered through menial jobs. Jason Sokol is an assistant professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, named one of America's top young historians by History News Network. Again, his new book is All Eyes Are Upon Us. He will have a reading and signing this Thursday at 7 o'clock at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Jason Sokol to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. Happy to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program and look forward to having you in town for the event. Give us an idea of what brought you to this subject.
In a way, I've been thinking about this my whole life. I grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts, and always realized that there was a deep and harsh racial divide in terms of racial inequalities in the city. And I wrote my first book on civil rights movement in the South, and ever since I published that, I sort of been turning back north where I'm from and trying to figure out this puzzle of what's different, what's the same about race in the North.
The premise, of course, is that the Northeast is progressive, certainly more progressive than many other parts of the country.
Right.
And that while we were looking at race and these issues, that this part of the country was ahead of the game. What you write in the book of what a struggle it was and what a struggle it was to live up to that impression. So I guess the obvious question is, how did that impression get molded in the first place?
Well, my book starts out during World War II, which was, of course, a time when the South had Jim Crow segregation and lynchings. And so Northerners thought of themselves as the last place for freedom. That is, they looked south below the Mason-Dixon line. They saw the Jim Crow system. They looked to Europe, and they saw Hitler's march across Europe, and they said, wow, the Northeast, this is really the land of freedom and democracy. If it's going to survive anywhere, it's going to survive here. So that's where my book starts out. But, of course, there's a long history of this. I mean, Northerners think of ourselves as the heirs to the abolitionists and the Pilgrims, and we don't think so much also that slavery existed in the Northeast. Slaves built New York City. So it's a sort of a contradictory and conflicted history that I talk about.
As you say, you started in World War II of looking at this. What was the turning point where there were some questions of where there were Northern leaders who were conscious of this gap between the political ideals and
right.
the racism that was present in these communities?
Well, during World War II, one important turning point was the Second Great Migration, in which African Americans moved from the South up to northern cities. And so northern cities suddenly had this new influx of African Americans, and many cities that did not have a large African American population, for instance, Boston, 3% black before World War II. Well, by the 1960s, Boston was getting up toward 20%. So suddenly these cities had to figure out how to handle this, and they did not figure out how to handle it very well. They ended up basically corralling African Americans into certain very specific neighborhoods. For instance, in Brooklyn, African Americans would end up in Bed-Stuy. In Boston, they would end up in Roxbury. And they'd end up in often segregated neighborhoods and menial jobs, segregated schools. So Northern leaders, I think, did a poor job of integrating and desegregating their cities and opening them up. And so these cities did not become really true bastions of freedom. They became bastions of segregation.
You write in the book about Ed Brook, a Massachusetts Republican, the first African-American ever elected to the U.S. Senate by popular vote. A rise and fall story. What do we learn from his story?
Well, I think we learn a lot. I mean, Ed Brook was the first African-American elected to the Senate by popular vote. That is the first time that a state's voters actually chose a black person to represent them in the Senate. That was in 1966, when Massachusetts was 97% white. And here's Brook, who's an African-American. Not only that, he was also a Republican in a deeply Democratic state. He was also a Protestant in a deeply Catholic state. But Brook showed that if an African-American appealed to white voters in a certain way, that is, he pitched himself as a colorblind candidate, and he told the voters basically that they could rise above racism and segregation by voting for him, and that they could show that Massachusetts was this beacon of democracy and freedom, and he was able to emerge victorious in 66 and 72. So I think one thing it shows that Northeasterners are and were vulnerable to any campaign that could mobilize this idea of their home being a special place where certain breakthroughs were possible, you know, where this was unimaginable in the Jim Crow South that an African American could become a senator. And the other thing it shows us was that simply electing a senator doesn't solve one's problems of segregation and racism. I mean, the segregation in Boston simply increased, even though Brook was in the Senate. So that's what I think Brook can tell us.
You write in the book, there is a section, a chapter in the book called A Tale of Two Hartfords, and you're writing about the early to mid-1980s. And the subtitle was Politics and Poverty in a Land of Plenty. And it serves a bit of a microcosm of what was happening in the Northeast at that time. Why was Hartford such a good petri dish for what was happening?
Well, because Hartford became one of the poorest cities in America. I think by the year 2000, it was counted as indeed the poorest city. And the staggering thing is that Connecticut, by per capita income, was the wealthiest state on average. So you really did have this almost an island of poverty amid this land of plenty. And Hartford showed this transition among Northeastern cities from being, they had been places of cosmopolitanism and progress. And they had been wealthy places early in the 20th century, but by the time that they start to lose manufacturing jobs and lose industry, you saw a white flight to the suburbs, and you saw jobs leave to the suburbs. And what you ended up with was cities that were overwhelmingly poor and inhabited by racial minorities, like Hartford, and then suburbs that were increasingly rich and white. And I think Hartford just showed that dichotomy better than anywhere else.
In 1981, they elected Thurman Milner as their mayor, the first black mayor of any New England city. What impact did he have?
Well, Milner was an interesting case. He served three terms. They were each two-year terms. So he served from 1981 to 87. And Milner ran a campaign in which he had a multiracial message. You know, he said, I'm not just running for the African Americans of Hartford, but I want to be everyone's mayor. And so he tried to follow that up a bit with his actions. He also tried, as he could, he tried to close that gap, the income gap between blacks and whites. He initiated quite a few different plans that would divert money to African-American construction firms, and he tried to begin some low-income housing plans, but he was up against forces that were too big for one mayor, I think, to solve. That is, the loss of these manufacturing jobs, the loss of residents and wealth to the suburbs. And by the end of his term, the economic contrasts in Hartford had grown even deeper. I mean, the racial and economic inequality had grown even more entrenched.
The term of Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, is ending. What footprint do you think he has had on the state of Massachusetts and really the region as a whole when it comes to the politics and the racism that you write about in the book?
Well, I think that was a really important moment in the history of Massachusetts, where the racial reputation of Massachusetts, Massachusetts and particularly Boston, was still suffering from the reputation of the Boston busing crisis. That is, people thought of race in Massachusetts, and they thought about this really vicious violence that had exploded across the city in the 1970s. When Patrick started running for governor in 2006, Mayor Tom Menino said, you know, when people think of race in Boston, they think of Ted Landsmark getting hit with the American flag. That is, in 1976, anti-busing protesters really assaulted this black man with the American flag. So Patrick offered to Massachusetts voters that they could start to overcome this past and reassert their claim to being on the frontier of racial democracy, is how I think of it. And he talked a lot about aspirations. That is, vote your aspirations, vote what you want your state to be. So he presented, I think, an important turning point in the state's civic life, that is, thinking of itself again as a leader and as a beacon to the nation. Now, again, Patrick couldn't himself solve the poverty and the crime in Roxbury. So you have this dual story again, where I think it was meaningful that he inhabited the state house for 8 years and still inhabits it, but he couldn't ultimately bring us to a final place of racial equality just with his policies.
And of course, his administration is taking place at the same time in the age of President Obama, and there are linear stories there.
Right. I do try to bring the book all the way up almost to the present. And one thing I was struck by when studying just the voting totals for Obama's 2008 election and his 2012 election was the extent to which he received great support in the Northeast, even among white voters. In 2008 and 2012, the states of the Northeast voted for Obama overwhelmingly, and he got the majority of white votes. And then if you look at the Deep South, it's stunning the degree to which white Southerners rejected Obama. I mean, 1 in 10 white Southerners voted for Obama in the states of Mississippi and Alabama both times. So I think in terms of racial politics, I argue that the North and South are as different today as they were 50 years ago. In that sense, we haven't come all that far, though the fact that Obama could be elected and then perhaps more importantly reelected suggests that we're beginning to make some headway, at least in the electoral arena.
The name of the book is All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, The Conflicted Soul of the Northeast. It is published by Basic Books. Jason Sokol will be at the Odyssey Bookshop on Thursday night at 7 o'clock. You can find out more information about that event by going to odysseybks.com. odysseybks.com. Again, it's Thursday night at 7 o'clock. The name of the book, All Eyes Are Upon Us. Jason Sokol, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe. My pleasure.
Very nice to have you with us. Again, you can find out more information at odysseybks.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.